Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. On January 17th, Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+, and we can't wait for you guys to see it.
And before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recap podcasts.
Yep. Each weekday beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits and brilliant insights from our cast and crew and us.
Patricia Arquette, Britt Lauer, Zach Cherry, John Turturro, the list goes on.
All your favorite Lumen employees, their friends, families, enemies, in your feed every single weekday.
And here's the best part. After that, we're going to keep going. Tune in weekly as we recap every episode of season 2. The podcast drops on the same day the episode comes out.
It's the Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
On Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There really are some parallels in Mardi Gras because everywhere else in the world it's just Tuesday, literally, like we always say on Mardi Gras. But here, you know, we're at the convention center, media center, and we got the Super Bowl going on. If you're going to work today and just have a normal day going, highs of 74, could be beautiful really throughout the entire Super Bowl week. No rain until Tuesday, well after the game. And we're talking about highs between 75 and 80 and sunshine all the way through Sunday. So literally Chamber of Commerce weather right now at 63 degrees. They sent out a fog alert last night, but I didn't see any fog on the way in. So if y'all did, you can text us at 504-260-1870. While this is the center of the world when it comes to sports and events happening, the country continues to function, the world continues to spin, and President Trump continues to, I guess, rattle Washington be a good way to put it. Andy Smith joins us now, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing well. Glad to hear you got some good weather down there, and I think it's good to see that New Orleans is in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, well, we're not in the Super Bowl. We're hosting.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you're trying to be a smart guy, huh? That's all right. That's okay.
Well, you know, heads are spinning certainly in Washington right now. That's or around the world, too. Nobody quite knows which way to focus.
Yeah, let's talk about, I don't know where you want to begin, because I know where I want to begin. Let's start with executive orders and what President Trump is doing. And this goes back to a conversation you and I had years ago about executive orders, where Congress in a lot of ways has abdicated their duties. So it's like there's a vacuum, and President Trump's more than willing to fill that vacuum with executive orders. If that's accurate, maybe take off on that and explain.
Well, it is. The problem is with legislation is that Congress can write the laws, but somebody has to administer them. And that's the executive branch under the president. And the president has leeway as to what to do and what not to do. You can think about this. If you got a speed limit on the road, and if you're driving 5 miles and over the speed limit, a police officer can pull you over. And they may or may not give you a ticket, depending on how nice you are to them or whatever. So there's some wiggle room there in the enforcement of laws. That's the same way in the laws that are passed by Congress. But over the last, I'd say, 50 or 60 years, Congress has expanded the scope of the government. You know, the scope of the government has expanded, I should say, both presidents and Congress. But the specificity of the laws has declined. And you've seen presidents pushing and pushing and pushing, because that's what branches of government do. They push to expand the power and control that they've got against what Congress maybe wanted them to do. And I think it's most famous in the Obama administration, where they lost in the 2014 midterms to Republicans. And Obama says he's got a phone and a pen and he's going to do what he wants. Created many things and went against laws in several areas. During the Trump administration, you saw the same sort of thing. The Biden administration certainly saw the same sort of thing, pushing back against doing what you wanted rather than what the law says. And Trump is continuing that. Congress they're complaining most about it, but they're the ones that are responsible because they were not specific enough in the laws that they created in the first place.
So it's like Mad Magazine back in the day, spy counter spy, right? What happens next? And I guess it goes to party leadership, because if the Republicans in the Senate or the House were concerned with the power of their respective bodies more than the party, then they would maybe challenge the president, or the Democrats would either way, but they don't have enough people to do that. Accurate?
Well, the Democrats don't have enough to really make a big difference on their own. They're going to have to rely on some Republicans. And Republicans are saying, how did I get here? And a lot of them saying, we got here because of Donald Trump. So
and
we don't
do
want
I
to antagonize
too,
Trump.
Right? And how do I stay here?
Absolutely. You got to keep this a nice gig. You want to keep it. But if you're you could get primaried by Trump supporters, and that happened to many Republicans over the last cycles, and they lost their seats that way. So it's a matter of power, keeping your power. But the Congress has not, as a body, not as an institution, wanted to push back much against this this trend towards increased executive power, because they like it when it works in their party's favor, and they stamp their feet when it goes against them.
When it comes to division of powers, the powers and the power behind it, it would seem to me that Trump's in control right now, because he's got the Republicans in the House and Senate more fearful of him and more loyal to him, however you want to phrase it, than they are concerned about protecting the strength of their respective bodies, whether it's the Senate or the House. Accurate?
Yeah, I agree right now that the amorphous thing that we call political capital, Trump certainly got it now. People, it's actually in politics is everything. Appearances is more important than reality, and it appears now that Trump is the most powerful person in Washington, and Democrats are willing to go along with that.
I'll use the word shrewd here, because it seems like there was a vacuum, and Trump sensed it maybe now like he didn't in his first term. And, man, he's seizing it and running with it. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He is in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino Power Seat as we broadcast live all week long here at the Morial Convention Center, the host committee's media center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. Back in a flash right now, time for traffic on WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, broadcasting live from Morial Convention Center, the host committee center, media center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. Andy Smith is in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino power seat now as we talk about the Trump administration trying to move its agenda through. Tell me what's going on with the FBI, because this did get my attention where, let's go into the influence of Elon Musk. And what's going on with the FBI confirmation hearings, Kash Patel, I think is the guy's name, and firing or at least sending out a questionnaire to FBI agents to see what their involvement was with investigation into the January 6th riots. Take it from there, Andy, if you will, please.
I think that's interesting to unpack that, because there's been a lot of concern about our intelligence services and our law enforcement services, not just during the Trump administration, but in prior administrations as well. And who controls them? Are they kind of rogue on their own at times? Are their investigations politically inspired? Trump certainly believes that he was investigated unfairly, and that the FBI was involved with that. And that is an executive branch agency that the president should have control over. So what he's doing is pushing as hard as he can to exert his control over the political direction of the IRS. Both with his appointment of Kash Patel, who it's safe to say that members of the FBI don't want to see him as the director. They want to see one of their own guys in there. And it's a lot of pushback, because there are some things that would show Democratic Party fiddling or Biden administration fiddling with those investigations of Trump. So the thing that he's doing here that makes it look bad, though, is, in my mind, is, you know, you can fire people, but this loyalty test, so to speak, is, I think, a problematic aspect
of
this.
But let me just jump in
before
we run out of time, because at that time, those agents, and I'm concerned with the overall security effort in the country here. We got the Super Bowl gone and terrorism and all that kind of stuff. But you could be losing experienced agents here who, at that time, correct me if I'm wrong, they were just doing their job. And I know that that's a pejorative phrase, but they were just doing what they were told to do by the agency that was then run or headed by President Biden. So they were just doing their job. And this to me seems kind of unfair. Thoughts?
I think that that's fair to say, because it's, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Mm-hmm. But during the Trump administration, when he was ostensibly in charge of the FBI, they were certainly investigating him. And I think that's probably what he's going back to. You're right that there are a lot of things that the FBI ought to be doing, maybe instead of investigating their bosses, and we should have them focus on that. And maybe that's the whole point of all this, is just to try to reorganize what it is that the FBI is responsible for. But like every bureaucratic agency everywhere, the goal is to expand your scope and expand your budget. Right. And I think the FBI has said the best way to do that is cozy on up to the people in politics.
And I get that if it's the Department of, you know, Interior, whatever. But when it comes to the security of the nation, my concern is that if for whatever reason Trump law, you know, brings in new agents and they start investigating Kamala Harris, and for whatever reason Kamala Harris becomes president in 3 years, just pick a name, it doesn't matter who it is, and then she goes and purges all the agents, it seems like we're starting from scratch every 4 years, and I don't think that's in the best interest of the country, is it?
Kind of sounds like a third world country.
Yeah, it does, Andy, as a matter of fact. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, talking about the Trump administration, and I'm getting some texts here. Some people think that it's the best thing in the world that he's doing. Other people think it's not so good. We'll take a break, come back. We're broadcasting live here at the Convention Center Host Committee's Media Center on Radio in the Radio Row in the Montreal Convention Center. It is powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. We'll come back and talk about name, image, and likeness and a prospective settlement possible in the House case. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. I have Tommy Tucker here at the New Orleans Convention Center with all the Super Bowl festivities going on. It'll be a beautiful day today. Spring-like, really, through next Tuesday, and that's all you need to know. It was a fog alert issued last night, but I'm not hearing about a lot of it other than some people texting in some patches of it on the causeway. This whole name, image, and likeness thing will put some fog in your head. If you have a hard time understanding it, welcome to the party. Mark Conrad joins us now, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. He's our guest in the Treasure Chest Casino virtual power seat. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about Livy Dunn and the suit that she filed, and maybe take a step back first and talk about the House settlement, which has nothing to do with the House of Representatives, although it does involve Congress, right?
Well, actually, no. It involves a settlement for
NCAA.
Right.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, it actually involves a lawsuit, a settlement of a lawsuit by an athlete called House representing many other athletes, and the settlement was agreed to by the lawyers for both sides. The question is going to be, will the settlement be approved? And that will be determined in April by the trial judge. The settlement involves some back pay for athletes, but it also involves a compensation scheme for present athletes going into the future that is capped at about $20 million per, up to $20 million per school. So, and that's been one of the centerpieces of the objections to that settlement, among other things. But most of the class of plaintiffs seem to have agreed and agreed onto the settlement. So I think it's a good bet that the judge is going to approve this settlement.
I tripped over myself with Congress before. What I was trying to say is, at what point does Congress get involved with any of this, or will they?
Well, that's a good question, because with the changes in Congress and the changes in administration, there's a possibility that Congress could vote a law that will give the NCAA some additional legal protections. Whether that will affect this case or not is a real question, but it will give the NCAA protection maybe against other lawsuits on antitrust law. And Senator Cruz is going to be the chair of the Senate committee committee dealing with that, and he's been sympathetic to some legislation going through, and that could be a change. So I think we have to watch Congress and see, and also watch the attitude of the president regarding this particular issue. So there is a possibility that for future cases, it could be limited by this potential law passed by Congress and signed by the president.
I hope this doesn't come as a severe shock to the audience, but sometimes politics and the judiciary can kind of overlap. When it comes to the partisanship here, basically the Republicans would be on the side of the NCAA, if you wanted to make it that simple, and the Democrats would be on the side of the players, almost like a union and a company kind of thing?
Yeah, on a 30,000-foot approach, I'd say that is generally more correct than not. But having said that, you know, a Republican-based Supreme Court ruled against the NCAA a few years ago, and Justice Kavanaugh in particular was very critical of its business operations. So I don't think the NCAA necessarily has all the support from Republicans, and many Republicans may feel that the NCAA doesn't deserve this kind of law. But more likely than not, I think that Republicans are going to be against the idea of college athletes being unionized as employees and getting a salary. I think that will be likely to change because the labor board is going to change in terms of its personnel, and many of the advocates on that end, which is not part of the case, but it's part of another kind of proceeding, will be gone. So I think that area is going to be, at least for the time being, going to be suppressed. In fact, attempts to unionize have been withdrawn in anticipation of rejection by the full National Labor Relations Board.
You know, if I had heard that phrase years ago, I might still be married and not be buying my house for the second time. From a 30,000-foot approach, that's somewhat accurate. I wish I knew that phrase then, Professor. So let me take a step back on all of this. And for people that have not been following this closely, because, man, it's very complicated stuff. Let me take a break here real quick, and then we'll pick it up. We come back. You can talk about the whole name, image, and likeness thing, and maybe we can zoom down to 20,000 feet and get an overview of how we got from there to here and what it means in the future as far as, because what we're talking about here is players that have already played getting compensated for their efforts and then moving forward what the landscape looks like. We're talking to Mark Conrad, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. If you have any questions or comments, text them in to the O'Connor Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. We're live from the Morial Convention Center at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. A quick break for traffic now on WWL. Quickly back to Mark Conrad, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. Tommy Tucker on WWL, live from the Morial Convention Center at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. So, Professor, if you can, in the minutes that we have left, tell us how we got from there to here with this House settlement and what it means for, where is the dividing line where this settlement addresses players that have had their time, and then moving forward, does it have anything to do with name, image, and likeness?
It sort of evolved over time because the NCAA, you know, was very strict about any kind of compensation and considered student athletes as amateurs. But starting about 10 years ago, a number of lawsuits started chipping away at that. Not specifically opening up the door to NIL, but coming pretty close. And the NCAA, just one day after the Supreme Court ruling, simply said, you know, we are going to change the rules because of the fear of more lawsuits, number one. And number two, more and more states were passing laws allowing NIL. And the NCAA realized that they were in an untenable position. But the question is how you do it. The question is how you organize it. The question is how the schools control it. And that's really open right now. And you know, any attempts to restrict that, you know, have been the subject of lawsuits. And the House case was just one of a number of lawsuits regarding NIL and how NIL is awarded, and the settlement pretty much said that it'll be considered as part of back compensation for students in some kind of financial standard. And also it said that students more generally in the future could potentially get some kind of quote-unquote compensation. They'll call it salary, but it's more than NIL. But at this point, we really have almost an open market, and we don't know where this is going to go, because it's just been, you know, the professionalization of college sports is upon us, and the last 2-3 years, you know, the events have been just swirling, and I can see lots of fans really confused from the model that used to be. So really stay tuned. I think that the settlement will be approved, even though there are some reasonable objections to it. And then we will go from there, and there'll be even more questions, I think, coming up in the future.
Only 30 seconds left. Going forward, does the Commerce Clause have anything to do with this as far as congressional action?
Well, Congress certainly has the power, you know, to pass laws regulating college sports. Absolutely, they're engaged in interstate commerce. You know, they negotiate TV deals, you know, streaming deals, etc. They sell tickets. They travel. So there would be no constitutional problem in dealing with that. But the question is, what kind of law would be passed? And do you give the NCAA basically a get out of jail card, meaning an antitrust exemption, prohibiting future cases?
Thank you.
Of that type.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, we get here early, get everything going, and then it builds throughout the day with sports talk all the way till this evening here on WWL. Of course, business goes on in the city. Jared Bologna joins us now, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. Hey, Jerry, how are you?
Good morning, Tommy. It's an exciting week in the city.
It is. I'm telling you, I wanted to ask you, does some of this kind of wash over on a Jefferson Parish? I would think it would with hotels and restaurants and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. There are events that we're able to capitalize. I think all of our hotels are at capacity. Restaurants are enjoying a great week. We have events like Oyster Night tomorrow that all the restaurants will be celebrating. So definitely a spillover effect here.
Also, I was driving around a couple of weeks ago and went through your area and drove back by the, I guess, where your offices are and the TPC and everything else. The TPC is going to be pretty well booked this week, I would think, huh?
I think TPC is going to enjoy a great week. NOLA Motorsports back there. You see the Esplanade Mall being used as overflow parking for volunteers. So this is a major event that encompasses the entire region.
I was driving around Jefferson Parish, specifically went to Lafitte and all over, just spent a Saturday morning, was after it snowed, doing that. Talk about that area back there, if you will, Jerry, because that is amazing when you drive around back there by NOLA Motorsports, by the TPC, and that is an area of development for Jefferson Parish in the future, is it not?
Well, we sort of call that our Less Frontier. Within Jefferson Parish, we always talk about the East Bank being totally developed. The West Bank presents some opportunities for new development, and that area is some of our only large green space that's within the levee protection system. So we have the Churchill Park Business and Technology Park back there that we recently announced will be adding a new food and beverage, regional food and beverage incubator. NOLA Motorsports has plans to expand. You have the Ilario Sports Complex that'll be coming online in a couple of months that'll capture travel, baseball, and soccer from around the country. So there's a lot of synergy back there, a lot of good anchors. Patrick Taylor Science and Technology School, one of the top public schools in the state of Louisiana, and Delgado's River City Campus.
I'm a little bit confused about where I was driving. That would be down...
That would be Nicole Boulevard, which runs behind the TPC and in front of NOLA Motorsports or La Palco as it goes into 90, which is kind of the front of the golf course.
For y'all that have not taken a ride down there, I suggest you do it, because it's like you think you're in the middle of nowhere, then all of a sudden it's like, wow, that soccer complex you mentioned is going to be fantastic, and they're still building that, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're excited about that coming online because just like the Super Bowl brings in people from around the world, we think this is going to be certainly a driver of regional and within the country of travel baseball, which is big business.
Mm-hmm. What's going on with the big place, the big plot of ground on the expressway right as you get off the UAP Long Bridge and merge on the 90? What's going to be there? Do you know?
Trying to think of which one you're talking. They're working on several projects over there.
Where Moons used to be, or maybe Moons still is in that area, if that helps you?
Oh, on the West Bank side?
Yeah, on the West Bank.
I'm at a loss. We have Loop Linen, which is built. Loop Linen is building their large new complex there at LA 18. You have Atmos Energy building their new headquarters sort of at the base. I think you're talking about the expansion next to the Mardi Gras. There's like a Mardi Gras supplier there.
Okay. I didn't know what it was, but it just whenever I see a big piece of ground being cleared and filled, I always wonder what it is because it seems like more business, which is what you're all about, right, Jerry?
That's it. More business. That leads to better quality of life and a higher tax base, which leads to better education, better police protection, and that's what we're all about.
Tell me about the More Here campaign. What's up with that?
Last year, the parish council dedicated some funds to us, really to develop a all-encompassing campaign, a new front door for Jefferson Parish. And we developed the More Here campaign, and that's sort of a play off of there's a lot of double entendre there. But when we are working with businesses, sometimes we sell them on the fact that if they come to a market like this, like the New Orleans region, they can be more here. They can be a bigger fish in a smaller pond versus if we're in a competitive posture with an Atlanta or a Dallas. Companies may want to be there, but they're just another number and they don't get the attention that we can give them here. So the More Here campaign was released at our annual luncheon late last year, but you'll see the billboards up this week around Super Bowl, and we have a new website that we'll be rolling out around the middle of this year. And it's all about being more here, innovating more here, all sorts of things.
Is there a counterpart to what we're talking about in Churchill Park on the East Bank, or not really? That's all pretty well developed.
Well, in all honesty, Churchill was developed to be a West Bank alternative to Elmwood.
Okay.
Elmwood has been very successful over the years, but despite its lack of planning, for example, Elmwood, most of the businesses in there have a lack of parking. They don't have a lot of turning radius for trucks, things like that. We always envision Churchill to be a well-planned alternative to Elmwood. And I think as the land prices in Elmwood continue to escalate and you see Elmwood sort of switch from the historic warehousing and logistics hub it once was to more commercial, more apartments, more living, the land prices continue to explode in Elmwood. And so the Churchill and that West Bank area that you're pointing to right on the other side of the Huey really presents a great opportunity for businesses to purchase cheaper land and still have great access to roads and the airport and the river and everything else.
We'll take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll talk about residential development because that thought was running through my mind as I drove around. And I would suggest to everybody, every now and then, get in a car and just drive around, see what's new in Jefferson Parish, what's new in Orleans Parish, St. Charles, you name it, because you'd be surprised. And I'm going to tell you, man, it's jaw-dropping when you see the NOLA Motorsports and TPC and all that area that's open back there and Patrick Taylor and so forth at Churchill Park. We're talking to Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO. We'll continue the conversation when we come back. We're broadcasting live from the Morial Convention Center at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. More when we come back. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back here at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in Memorial Convention Center, celebrating Big Game Week in New Orleans, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. We're talking with Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. He is in the Treasure Chest Casino power seat, virtually. You didn't know that, did you, Jerry?
I hope I'm winning.
You are. You. If you are, we're going to have somebody look into it. Anyway, let's talk about... Pat Connick texted me, a friend of mine, good friend, talked about the asking you to expand on the travel ballpark, and we've already addressed it. But Pat's, you know, lives in Marrero, not too far from there, proud of it, as he should be. And I just think, we can also go into residential development in that area if there's any opportunity for that. I don't know anything about flood maps or any of that, but there is so much area out there, and it's so nice, Jerry.
Well, I think one of the things Senator Connick is really excited about is when these families do come to the area. Oftentimes, the players are there on scene, and that there's the ability to establish a village that can house those players, and then you have all the opportunities for the parents to play golf, go on swamp tours, go down to the quarter. Whatever that case may be, and that's where you really capture a lot of that disposable income here in the community. And we have a lot of opportunities both there at the ballpark. I know Senator Connick is excited about Hope Haven and the redevelopment of that and the ability of developments like that to capture some of that spillover effect as well.
Man, I think y'all are on top of it with that travel ball. People that are not involved have no idea how big that is unless they've been to Florida on vacation and seen some of the business, I guess, that Pensacola and Panama City Beach gets and those kind of things. And I guess, Jerry, that's what you're hoping to do, attract some of that?
Well, I think from our viewpoint, so many of these existing travel ball facilities have nothing to offer other than the ball. And we feel like families would much prefer to come to an area like this region where there is so much to do other than play ball when the kids are not playing ball. I think we have a huge advantage over any of the other existing facilities.
This is kind of from left field, but somebody texted in about, they're saying the lights look so good on the Crescent City Connection for the Super Bowl, and they're talking about how awesome it would look for the UEP Long to be lighted as well. I joked with Cynthia Lee Sheng that should be her legacy, having that bridge lit. What would be involved in that? Has anybody been talking about that or looking into it?
We actually, off and on over the years, have looked at it, and we've taken a more serious approach here, I would say, in the last year. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of parties involved in that. With the UEP, of course, you have the Public Belt Railroad and the rail providers that have some say-so, DOTD, there are a lot of parties. But that's not to say it can't be done, and we're trying to coalesce all those parties and identify the funding. It's not a cheap proposition, but the fact that LED technology is much better than the old way of doing things and cheaper for maintenance. We think we might be able to get that done, and it is something that we would like to bring to fruition.
So, scale of 1 to 10, nobody's given a deposition here under oath or anything. Likelihood of that happening as it stands now, you would say?
I'd give it a 6 or a 7.
I like it. Thank you, Jerry Bologna. A pleasure as always. Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. And again, I would suggest if y'all have not gone to that Churchill Park area, set some time aside, take a ride on a nice day, because you could be surprised at what's going on out there. All week long, WWL is broadcasting live from the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in the Memorial Convention Center, where we're celebrating Big Game Week in New Orleans. Break for news, and we're back on WWL. Yep, and our guest in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino power seat is A.C. Cooper, president of Louisiana Shrimp Association, here to talk about shrimp fraud. How you doing, A.C.?
I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you today?
I'm all right. Tell me about shrimp fraud, and how do you know it, and how do you prove it, and all that stuff.
Well, you know, Tommy, you know, we had to pass legislation in 2019 on the restaurants, and the restaurant association said, oh, they're following the guidelines, and then come to find out there's 2,600 violations, and yet no fines. So this past year, we got the Senator Connick passed a bill to where now they have fines behind it and they have to do it. So I think this is going to be a big plus for us. And not only that, we have a company now going around testing the restaurants to see, because they have a DNA test to test and see if they really are domestic or if they selling imports. And what he's finding is just unreal. Houston, I think, was, no, Galveston was 90% lying, saying they were selling Gulf shrimp and they're selling imports. Baton Rouge, 30% is selling Baton Rouge. But if you do the numbers and put all of the restaurants, add up all the restaurants and see how many is doing bad, it winds up to being $28 million in loss. So 80% of our restaurants go to shrimp goes to restaurants. And when the restaurants are not selling our shrimp, then we have a problem. And that's been our biggest problem. You know, these cheap imports coming in and selling. None of these people that come to New Orleans with the Super Bowl wants to eat Chinese or Indian shrimp or Indonesian shrimp. They're coming here to eat our shrimp. And, you know, that's a big problem. So we got DNA tests now starting to show that, you know, they're lying. If you put a boats or pictures and betray our culture and you sell an imported shrimp, there's going to be repercussions for that.
Yeah, you know, you talk about, give me that number again about percentage of Louisiana shrimp that go to restaurants, because it would seem as though at some point there's a disconnect. It's like, well, wait a minute, you're serving shrimp, but we're not selling them, so where are you getting them, right? I mean, would you really need
exactly
to prove it?
Yeah, well, if that's what we have to do to go into the restaurant. As a task force, we hired a company called CDU going around, and he does the DNA testing. And he's going to be in New Orleans pretty soon. And Morgan City, when they had the festival, the Shrimp and Petroleum Festival, man, it was just unbelievable. I think two of them were selling Louisiana shrimp right there on the coast, and the rest of them were selling imports. So if the restaurants don't buy our product, then it's a slow-moving product. And then here we go. We can't go out. We can't sell our shrimp. So all these cheap imports is just killing our economy, and all our coastal communities are just suffering because of it.
So are the shrimp being caught now and restaurants aren't buying them? Or if they were to crack down on the imported shrimp being passed off as Gulf shrimp, would that mean more people would be going out to catch shrimp because there'd be a market for it where there isn't now?
Correct. In 2014, we had a little glitch in the imports. We went down about 15%, and our prices went up. You know, we can see the difference in the prices. So we don't need a big change, but we need a change. But it has to be done at the restaurant level. And look, education is the key. People need to know what they're eating. You know, they come in with antibiotics, steroids, all kind of stuff. And yet our federal government is not even looking at that. They test less than 1%. So if you go in a restaurant and say, well, we depend on the government to make the test and make sure it's good, well, that's it's not nothing to lean your back on and say it's okay. It's gonna be Louisiana shrimp. Mm-hmm. But just about every restaurant you go to says Louisiana shrimp, but yet they're selling imported shrimp. And I know people come to Louisiana, they sure don't want to eat shrimp from India.
And there is a law against that. The problem is enforcing it and actually putting some teeth into it and finding people for not following the law, right?
Well, there's a couple of things, like I said, we're doing. Mike Strand, in the legislation, Mike Strand has the authority to go in and test. Now, they're going to go into these plants and get these imported shrimp, and they're going to start testing lots of them. And when they find a lot dirty, we passed legislation in 2020 to where we can destroy it. If we test it bad, if they test it bad, then they have the right to go in there and grab that whole lot of shrimp, pull it from the shelves and destroy it. So we got a lot of things looking up for us here in Louisiana because, you know, we've been working with the legislature. We work with Washington. It's just a matter of either we're going to do it and survive or we're just going to lose the culture. You know, New Orleans are a culture city. We part of the culture when you talk about seafood, music, and the way we are. But yet, it's tend to forget about the real culture of Louisiana.
Now, let me take a break. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back because I got to wonder about the part of the wholesaler in this and how the imported shrimp get to the restaurant in the first place. We're going to take a break. Okay. We'll be right back. We're at the host committee's media center on Radio Row in the Morial Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So, celebrating Big Game Week in New Orleans. We'll be right back after a look at traffic on WWL. Tommy Tucker here all week long on WWL, broadcasting live from the host committee's media center on Radio Row and the Morial Convention Center, celebrating Big Game Week in New Orleans, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. We're visiting with A.C. Cooper. He's in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino power seat now, talking about imported shrimp. So, A.C., here's what I'm trying to figure out. So the restaurant's got to get these shrimp from a wholesaler, right? So rather than go to the restaurant level, why don't they just go to the wholesaler that's importing the shrimp and stop it there?
Well, that's what this new law does with Mike Staff. He's going to be able to go into the plants and all the imports coming in, he's going to be able to go in there and check these shrimp and see if there's something in them. Because when LSU did their study, man, it was like 40 samples and 32 samples tested bad for antibiotics, veterinary antibiotics residue in it. So, and that's banned in the U.S., but it's here, and we're allowing the people to eat that.
Somebody texted this in, and I think it's an interesting question. Where is the price difference occurring? Because I'm having a hard time understanding how they can go shrimping in India or China. And then do they shrimp them frozen? Is that how they come here?
Yes, sir. What happens is, Tommy, you know, that their currency is different to ours. If theirs is four times more worth of ours, and they do it by the currency difference and the volume they send in, and that's where they make the money at, mostly the volume. They brought over 2 billion pounds in last year, 2 billion. This country only eats 1.5, 1.6 billion. So every year you got 500 million pounds of shrimp excess in this country before we even get to go catch one shrimp. They bloody. It's everywhere.
Somebody texted in. We only got 30 seconds left here. AC, they want to know, just like if America was to go to manufacturing things and stop importing things, the price would go up because of the labor cost. They're wondering if imported shrimp go away and we eat nothing but domestically produced shrimp, what would that do to the price?
It would go out of the roof. Like I said, we only had a 15% downfall on the imports in 14, and our prices just doubled just that quick.
So that's from the shrimper's standpoint, but from the consumer's standpoint, the price would go up as well, right?
Well yes. You know, it would go up, but just think about this. What would you rather eat? Something with antibiotics that you don't know where it came from in these ponds because they're full of green algae and they do all kind of stuff. They put pesticides and keep the algae out of it. What would you really eat? Is it worth paying a dollar more for a plate of food? And another
thing. Thank you, AC. We got to go, but there's another point I'll make after the news here on WWL. I just realized what that song was that we've been playing. It is currently 8:15, and we are here live. Jason Williams, District Attorney, joins us now to talk about what's going on. How you doing, D.A. Jason Williams?
Good, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I'm good. I got to ask about Mom. How's she doing?
She's doing really wonderful, man. I'm blessed to have her still with me. Thank you.
Y'all getting out, seeing a little bit of the Super Bowl stuff all around with the lights in Jackson Square and all that? Jason? Did he drop out, Tim? All right, we'll get back with Jason Williams in a second. He's going to talk about the importance of funding education in a community after Mayor LaToya Cantrell wants to renegotiate a deal. $20 million legal settlement, programs that include or provide mental health services and job training to students. Promised funding for the next decade that could be in jeopardy, and the city council members had a press conference the other day, including Jason Williams, who's not a city council member, obviously the district attorney, but it goes to the importance of education. So I was asking Jason before we cut out, you and Mom have a chance to head out and see some of the stuff going on in the city with the Super Bowl, like the lights in Jackson Square and so forth?
We have not, man. I've had just a little bit too much work in 2025. It's been all curves and no breaks.
Find some time to spend time with your mama. That's what you're supposed to do. Let's talk about
You're absolutely right.
what's going on with the mayor, and take us back for context, Jason, for people that missed the story with Super Bowl and everything else. What happened with this funding issue?
So there was a tax that was being collected for quite some time, many, many years, and a percentage of that was supposed to go to the school system, and it simply wasn't going. The city was collecting it, but that money was not being allocated to the school system. It's over $100 million that is owed. There's been a dispute. There's been lawsuits about that. And a few months ago, I believe it was late October, early November, city council, along with some administration officials, were working together to try to find a settlement that would end the lawsuit and would get our schools funded so that our kids would have the teachers in place come next year. They agreed on an amount. They worked out a term sheet. There was a line item put in the budget that was amended by the administration and signed off on. And it appears between last week and Monday, there's reversal of the commitment to pay that money to the school system. And so, you know, as a lawyer, when you work to resolve and settle something, when two parties do that and you commit to it, you can't back out of that. That's a commitment. That's a promise. And there's ample evidence of it. I've worked with Councilmember Geruso, and he is meticulous for details. As you know, he's head of the budget committee, always dots every I, crosses every T. I've seen the paperwork. And, you know, beyond that, this was a commitment to our children. And you can't break promises to kids.
So I'm going to call on you, the lawyer part of you here. Not, you know, again, this is not any kind of criminal thing that you're looking at. Just to be clear, Jason Williams is not on for that. He's on, and we'll talk about that in a minute, about the importance of these programs in education when it comes to keeping kids out of the juvenile justice system. But when it comes to this whole precursor to this, where did the dispute come in? If I'm confused about what the law called for, the money was collected. Where did this dispute arise?
You know, there was no dispute. The city, school, no, there's nobody who says this money is not owed to schools. That's clear. Mm-hmm. The issue is it wasn't paid for such a long period of time that it was well beyond what was owed in by 2025 was well beyond what the city could afford. And so both sides struck a deal for upfront money. I think it was about $20 million with a commitment to continue to fund important programs that are really keeping kids out of the criminal justice system. This is not I'm not being hyperbolic when I say this. You are absolutely right. When schools are properly funded, I'm not saying well funded. I'm just saying properly funded. The criminal justice system has a whole lot less work. That's a fact, right? And I think of this the same way I think of the issue with the police department. Several years ago, when people were talking about funding issues, not paying police enough, not having enough money dedicated to making sure we have a right-sized police department, those cries were ignored. And then we got to a point where we couldn't make up the difference. We couldn't, we had the money, but we couldn't find the police. We couldn't find people who wanted to come and do the work. And if schools don't have this money, let's play it forward. If schools don't have this money, or this commitment of the money, at least, when they're getting ready for the next school year, these teachers are going to take jobs elsewhere if they don't know that there is a place for them in Orleans Parish. And then, as always, when in the 11th hour, when the city finds the money, we won't have teachers available. There's already a teacher shortage. And it's a very sort of precarious situation as it relates to public safety.
Let me take a break, and we'll continue to try to sort all this out when we come back. We're talking to D.A. Jason Williams as we continue to broadcast live here at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row in the Morial Convention Center. It's powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso, celebrating Big Game Week in New Orleans. And when we come back, I'm just curious if this money's been collected, and then the city said it doesn't have it, where to go? Where is it? We'll be right back on WWL right now. Look at traffic. All right, 8:25 now, talking to D.A. Jason Williams about Mayor Cantrell reneging on a deal to pay the school system $20 million. when $36 million was collected, correct me, Jason Williams, if I'm saying anything wrong here. So I guess I'm wondering, and people are texting in, if $36 million was collected and the settlement was $20 million, what happened to the other $16 million, and where's that money been in the meantime? If the city doesn't have it, where did it go?
You know, those are all good questions. Somebody should have some answer to those. And I believe more money was actually collected than just 36. And I think more money, a lot more money, is owed to the school board over the course of the years that it was collected. And you know, end of the day, it was collected. I would imagine it's been spent on other priorities. But that doesn't change a commitment and a promise and an agreement that it was supposed to go to the school system, which means that children of the city have been deprived of huge sums of money over the course of years. And this was an effort, this agreement 2 months ago or 3 months ago, was an effort to correct it and agree to it. Now, the school agreed to an amount that probably is close to maybe a quarter on a dollar or something along those lines. It's not the full amount that's owed to them. And as a lawyer, I can tell you that was a very reasonable resolution. A lot of money was left on the table. It helped the city out of from a fiscal crisis. There are always a number of other priorities, but I don't think there's any priority that's more important than the well-being of our young people. And when we don't invest in them, we see those results in the juvenile justice system and in the adult criminal justice system. And we can avoid that right now. We can get in front of that. We can plan better to get better outcomes. And whether you have children or not in the school system, you still share the broken sidewalks with them. And you're going to be in this community. We've all seen atrocities occur with young people being truant, not in school seats, and bad decisions are made. Some of this money will go to at-risk youth, not just kids that are doing everything we're asking them to do, but this is school system money. School system has a plan and a strategy that they've put in place with Fidelity. They have really good numbers, Tommy. Across the state, we've got some of the best numbers in the country in terms of raising the bar for our young people. So to tinker around with the funding right now really doesn't seem prudent.
If you don't get that education is the first step, the most economic step, the most positive step, Christian, whatever word you want to use, the right thing to do to keep kids out of the criminal justice system, that can't help you. But given that you do presume that, when it comes to unpacking all of this, Jason, under whose purview does that come? Who looks into where the money was collected or where was it spent? Would that be up to the inspector general to do? Or
I'm sure the inspector general has a role in that. If there were any misappropriations, I think there certainly should have been some protocols in place so that the mistake of this money not going to the school contemporaneously when it was collected. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions from the inspector general. I'm sure the council. I think they're having a hearing on February the 11th to discuss all of these issues. But at the end of the day, you know, we need to take politics out of this. We need to realize this is a crisis situation. When we find the money in the 11th hour, when the administration finds money in the 11th hour, it's going to be too late. So whether it means keeping the commitment and bringing it up into installments that the city can afford, or pushing the due date back on the money that was agreed upon, there's a lot of other middle ground that I think can be found between all parties. But we need to get and be about the business of finding that resolution quickly and not let it turn political, not let it be us against them. This is 100% about the children of this city, and we will pay in the long run if we don't resolve this in the short term.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate your time and your insights. This just, to me, looks like a big old giant jigsaw puzzle, and I got half the pieces. We're broadcasting live from the Morial Convention Center, the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and so more when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. Delighted to talk to B.J. Gannon with the Marine Corps actively.
No,
not
sir.
Not in
retired.
A Marine Corps, but once a Marine.
Always a Marine.
Always
Got
a Marine, who has a great organization, Sierra Delta, and we'll get into that. You're a combat veteran. I see you lost your leg. Tell me the story, if you don't mind.
Sure. Was activated. I served from 96 to 2000 on active duty. And then got out and took a job with Kraft Foods, but stayed in the Ready Reserves. Really loved being a Marine. Mm-hmm. And then obviously 9/11 happens. We get activated in 2004. Head over to Iraq Thanksgiving night. Regular patrol, and got hit with an IED. It was like the 13th I had been through, but this one got me good.
The 13th IED you had been through?
Yeah, danger close. So like they would, you know, when over there, they're not as skilled at fighting as we are, and so. A lot of times they would set it off, and it would be really close, but it wouldn't hurt anybody, maybe a little bit of scratches here and there. A lot of mortars coming in, a lot of IEDs going off and hitting one truck, and I was really close. And so it's when you go through them, it's not always a direct hit, right? It's kind of like mm-hmm. Battleship. Sometimes they miss.
Right.
But you get the repercussions of it. You get some of the flying stuff around. And the overblast, right, which is what we're learning is what's happening with TBIs and what we see also in the NFL. Mm-hmm. So wasn't, you know, when you get ready to go to war, you focus on going there, doing the mission, coming back, or either possibly dying. You don't think about the in-between.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got injured, what bothered me the most wasn't losing the leg, was not finishing the deployment.
Wow.
And that led to a lot of the psychological struggles and whatnot that we see that are common. And what the preposis that led me to start Sierra Delta was that the reason I think that so many of our veterans are struggling in this country is how we're delivering services. There's not just one group where you can join just because you're a veteran. You have to prove that you are disabled, that you have some sort of need. The VA gets $500 billion a year, and yet only services 30% of the total veteran population. You're not entitled to health care after you get out of the military. That's a myth in this country. You only get 1 year unless you file for a disability. So what we wanted to do different at Sierra Delta was just really provide a true thank you for your service. Let's get further up the stream. Why are we not engaging with these men and women when things are going okay? And by introducing a dog and helping them have empowerment on which dog it is, 68% of American households already have a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 5,000 vets that have come through Sierra Delta since 2017, 67% of them already had a dog. Let's focus on getting them training. Let's figure out what they want to do. I mean, we're not all sad stories, and that's half the problem.
See, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, you lost your leg, but I wouldn't even begin to use the word disability,
right?
Because that's not even in the stratosphere of what the way
no.
you present yourself, the way you act. Why did it work for you so well? Where did you find the strength not only to live a normal, happy, healthy life, a strong life, but to help other people? That's what I'm wondering about.
A simple answer is a dog. So when in 2005 I get retired from the United States military, I'm a mess. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm drinking too much. I'm getting in trouble with the law, divorce, bankruptcy.
Feeling sorry for yourself or not?
A little bit, but just angry too.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a lot of anger. And again, like things aren't working like advertised. Everybody talks about we love our veterans. Prove it.
Yeah. Thank you for your service. It's easy four words to say, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But it's also like what's behind that? Like we're wasting all this money. And where is it all going? You know, even our nonprofits, we need to hold them accountable. We have over 70,000 veteran-centric nonprofits. But at that lowest moment, I had just gotten out of jail for in the drunk tank for drinking and driving, right? And I just thought, like, it would have been better if I was killed that night. My kids would be better. My family would be better. All my friends would be better. But I had an old English bulldog. No special training. No special breeding. I mean, his only talents were, you know, getting slobber into places you thought was physically impossible to get slobber into and clearing a room with his farts, right? But as I'm going down that checklist to check out, I realize if I quit, this dog, who's been the one thing that loved me unconditionally.
The light bulb just went off.
Right.
It did, yeah.
And so if I check out, he's going to end up in a shelter because he's a big, gruff bulldog that's slobbery and stinky and nobody's going to want him and he's going to get killed.
So it gives vets a reason. It lets them know they're loved. It makes them responsible to somebody and for something,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I told you the light bulb went off. I got
it. Yeah. And so the thing is that we're just doing this wrong. Like, they say the average cost for a service dog in this country is $40,000. That's complete and total
It's crazy.
Yes, yeah, crazy, right? And then you look at, we got them on wait list.
And then you got so many dogs that need to be adopted that are being euthanized.
We kill 800,000 healthy, trainable, and adoptable dogs every year in this country. And then secondarily, when you look at how these traditional service dog groups are training these dogs, they're sending them to their donors, to prisons, to college campuses, all lay people with a checklist of things to do with the dog to socialize and train it. What the veterans miss the most is we're no longer going to be as important as we were when we wore that uniform. We don't have a team anymore. There's nothing that we're responsible for. So what we do differently is we work with the veterans to figure out where they're at in life and what they want from a dog. Right? So our core values spell EPIC. It's empowerment, purpose, innovation, and community. The empowerment piece is you decide, do you want to do agility training? Do you want to do scent detection training? Do you want to teach your dog how to run next to you while you're biking or while you're running? You know, you just want a good family pet? Or do you actually want a dog to do some service tasks for you? It's all possible. And the thing is that the dogs don't know the difference.
All right.
They just want to serve, right? The veterans, the biggest catastrophe we're doing is we're pre-training these dogs from, which is withholds 80% of the medicine. Mm-hmm. Now, I know
You're saying medicine as far as the help that the vets get, the veterans themselves would take, would get help from training the dog.
Yes. Working with a professional trainer.
Yeah.
It only takes 2 years to become an accredited dog trainer.
It makes so much sense what you're saying, right?
Yeah. So our grants are maxed out at $3,500. That comes from 8 years of studying it. We spent all kinds of money on all different types of training. Board and train doesn't work because I send that dog to a controlled environment with professional dog trainers. It's going to come out doing whatever. But day one, it gets to the house with a veteran, which nobody's spending any time with, right? They bring the veteran for a couple of days. They match the dog with them. They take all the pictures, mm-hmm. and they send away, you're going to be healed because this dog's going to do it. The dog doesn't do anything for people. What matters is what you do with the dog, and that's the empowerment piece. Right? And let them be honest in what they need. They're having to manipulate their own situation just to get the help that everybody says we deserve for raising our right hand in the first place.
It's 8:53. Before we run out of time, tell me how people get involved with this, because what you're saying, BJ, makes just every bit of sense. It's like, you know, take the government out of it. I hate to say that, but take the bureaucracy out of it. Take all of the experts out of it. Let's just get back to a dog matching up with a person, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about, right?
35,000-year technology, dogs and humans are working together.
So
right?
how do people get involved?
SierraDelta.com. Very simple. And again, hold a fundraiser. Like, we got people that host dinners. We got tailgates at a lot of NFL games that raise money. That's what we're focused on. We don't take any government money. We do have a great partnership with Blue Buffalo. It's been our corporate partner since the beginning, and they do a campaign at Walmart that generates the majority of our money. It's a money issue right now, and I know that sounds gross, right? But we're going to do 300 grants this year, just raising just slightly over $1 million. But I want to get to 10,000 annually by 2030, and all it takes is money. If you think about it, for every $3,500, we're helping a veteran and a dog, even service dogs. We're getting that done for that much money because the trainers now can lower their prices if they want to. If it costs a little bit more, the veterans have means, right? And then if they don't, we're working with the community that they live in to raise it, churches, American Legions, VFWs.
Do you work with shelters?
But we work through the veteran. These are adults, accomplished people. We're not infantiles. We don't need saving. Quite frankly, I think it's not the veterans that are broken. I think it's our society that's broken.
Obviously, you got the approval of the NFL or you wouldn't be here. You're thoroughly vetted.
Yes, sir.
The name of the organization is Sierra Delta. And, man, it's an honor talking to you. And I mean, sincerely, thank you for your service. And, again, it's easy to throw those four words out, harder to follow through on it.
Sure.
If you go to Sierra, this makes sense to you, go to SierraDelta.com and you can find out more about it.
Yes, sir.
Pleasure, sir. Thank you. What's the dog's name? Who do you have now?
I have Loki. It's a German Shepherd German Shepherd Collie mix rescue. He was abused for the first year of his life, was 40 pounds underweight, a ball of anxiety. They were going to put him down because he was reactive, but he reminds me of me. He's a high-functioning sociopath.
Right? Right there with you. You're sitting next to one. And who clears the room? You or the dog. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
We'll take a break.
Yes, sir.
8:55 more when we come back. The name of the organization is Sierra Delta. An honor talking to you, really. Sincerely, we'll take a break now. Back in a flash on WWL. as we continue our coverage here of the Super Bowl, big game, host committee's media center on Radio Row in the Montreal Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. We're celebrating big game week in New Orleans, and I was just talking to somebody. It's amazing the people you meet. I was talking to somebody from Ireland and telling him what a beautiful country he lives in, and his name is John Patrick McQuaid, or Michael Patrick McQuaid, and it seems like me telling people my name's Jean-Luc Boudreau from Louisiana, but that's his real name. And the only reason I mention that is during the course of the conversation, we were talking about the troubles and how it's more than a religious difference in Ireland between the Catholics and the Protestant. It goes back to Trevelyan and food, etc. Not to teach history here, but Joshua Fisher Birch joins us, researcher at the Counter Extremism Project. As we recover from the Bourbon Street attack, it seems like a lot more than 34 days ago. And what causes radicalization? And there are some common themes, and that, of course, was a big problem in Ireland back in the day. Good morning, Joshua. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How about yourself? Thank you for having me here, sir.
Thanks for taking the time. So, in the time since the Bourbon Street attack, have we learned anything more about the attacker or more about the way that it fits the profile of somebody being individually radicalized?
It's important to note that the investigation is still ongoing, and federal authorities are still continuing to look into the perpetrator and look into his background, looking into his online activity, and seeing what was there. There's a little bit more that has become public, but for the most part, a great deal of information that we knew previously is still what we have to go by.
What did we learn? What else has become public?
Well, primarily, I mean, what has been known is that on his way to New Orleans was that he released videos where he threatened his family, and he had spoken about potentially committing an act of violence against his family before realizing that that would not propel the message forward that he wanted to. The investigation has looked into the fact that he Googled the 2024 Christmas attack in Germany that happened shortly before his attack. And it's important to note that that attack was not done by a supporter of ISIS. That was done by an individual in Germany who was mimicking ISIS tactics that have been used to using vehicles to attack crowded areas. So this is a attack strategy that is, you know, has been used by ISIS supporters and has been used by others, and it's something that the terrorist group has put out in their propaganda. And other than that, the investigation is ongoing, and we all hope that more information is released.
You recommended, last time we spoke, a book by John Horgan, and I got the book, and I'm about halfway through it, and what amaze me about commonalities, I guess, between people that are self, is that the phrase self-radicalized, I guess, or the lone wolves? Is that
The term generally is lone actor. I'm sorry, but please continue.
No, that's okay. But what amazed me was the differences or the parallels between, is it really about the organization or is it really about them feeling as though they're empowering themselves, right?
Yeah. I mean, this really is across different ideologies. It's across different forms of, you know, violent radical ideologies. What we're talking about is we're talking about the factors that lead people to mobilize to commit acts of violence. To make another recommendation, actually, the National Counterterrorism Center has a pamphlet that they put out in 2021 that looks at these mobilizing factors that, you know, that I would recommend looking at. It's called the Mobilization Indicators Booklet. And a lot of this phenomena is, you know, this is across different ideologies. You know, these are, when it comes to online radicalization, when it comes to self-radicalization, and as well as people who are radicalized through others, whether that's online or in person, it's frequently a mix. But, you know, these factors go across different ideologies.
And that, to me, what was so interesting about the book, because there are different different causes, but yet these different organizations pull the same psychological strings to get people to act? Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that frequently is accurate. I mean, whatever the underlying ideology of the group or movement is, they're trying to get people to commit acts of violence, and they're trying to persuade them to do so in different ways by making appeals possibly to their sense of justice or their ego. The idea is to make people feel as if they are, you know, important historical actors in some cases who are sacrificing their lives to make an important change. It's preying on insecurities. And, you know, these are things that different groups use in order to recruit, in order to get people to commit acts of violence.
And I think the other thing that struck me reading the book was how the causes get these individuals to do the dirty work for them, and they want no part of it, right? In other words, like, I'm not going to about to put a bomb on myself, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to find any weakness that you have, and I'm going to exploit it and turn it against you to get you to wear the bomb, to get you to drive the truck, to get you to do the other thing. Accurate?
Yeah. I mean, this is the point of the propagandists. I mean, this is the point of, you know, frequently as well, you could even say in some cases, this is the point of the bomb makers. They're not the ones who are actively using the explosives. They're the ones who are experts in constructing the bomb that they then give to someone else. And many of these different groups, there are these different roles that people play in order to keep these violent movements and these conflicts going. So in this case, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I mean, part of this is about finding other people who will commit these violent acts.
The trick is now that working back from that, right? Because, pardon me, when it comes to the Bourbon Street attacker, it's easy to go back and say, yeah, check this off, check that off, check that off. How do you predict something like that and prevent it from happening? Are we making any inroads as far as that goes?
You know, it's an incredibly complicated process. It's something that different governments have quite a bit of experience doing. It's something especially this can be important with local governments, as well as in terms of monitoring of social media, as well as, you know, monitoring violent events in real life. But overall, you know, there's quite a bit that is known. A lot of this comes down to, you know, belief in conspiratorial thinking, belief in, you know, the potential use of violence against those of different identity categories is an important part of this, whether that's race or ethnicity or religion, you know, or others. And it, part of this is also these changes over time, because people change over time and, you know, people's beliefs change. And when that happens and people start mobilizing to violence, that's something that needs to be paid attention to. And there has been quite a bit of research that has been done on this.
So when it comes to an event like this, when it comes to organizations that are tasked with preventing, so we're talking about the Super Bowl is what I'm talking about, and organizations that are tasked with spotting some kind of radicalization like this and preventing it, does that fall primarily upon the Department of Homeland Security or the FBI, combination therein, and how concerned are you about changes at the FBI with experienced agents for political reasons and weakening the country, I guess, and our defense against that kind of thing?
Sure. I mean, this is, in terms of strategies and responsibility, this is something that's shared by the FBI, by the Department of Homeland Security, in many cases also by state and local law enforcement. In some cases, it can also be the role of, you know, social services organizations that do this as well and that are important in terms of keeping a lookout for people who are involved with there. In terms of your question related to what is going to happen, I think that the FBI's role in fighting homegrown violent extremism is something that will continue to be a big part of that agency going forward.
When it comes to the Bourbon Street attacker, and, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is they say if you see something, say something. That's about unattended packages. But in hindsight, is there anything that the family or friends of the Bourbon Street attacker could have seen or what should have seen and then have said something?
I mean, it's very important when people go through these changes, when people's behavior specifically changes, and when they start talking more about violence. That is important. But I think it's also very important to note that the Bourbon Street attacker was not, didn't really play a big role in his community. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a lot of personal connections, and that makes this a lot more difficult.
Any final thoughts?
No, I would highly encourage the people to check out the Mobilization Indicators booklet that was put out by the National Counterterrorism Center.
I looked at it while I was talking to you, and I would suggest the same thing because it goes to, and that's what spawned the if you see something, say something question about potential lone wolf actors. Thank you. I appreciate your time. Joshua Fisher Birch, researcher at the Counter Extremism Project. We're going to come back and talk to a member of the San Francisco committee who's getting ready to take the handoff for the next Super Bowl. We got to get this one over with first, though, of course. Tommy Tucker bringing you a front row seat at the Morial Convention Center, at the Host Committee's Media Center, Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. Back in a flash here on WWL. Yeah, 927 in the Treasure Chest Casino power seat is Marcus Brown, chair of the Super Bowl Host Committee, who is also executive vice president and general counsel for Entergy and was named one of the top in-house general counsels for companies worldwide in 2020 by the Financial Times. That's quite an accomplishment. Congratulations.
Well, thank you for having me, Tommy. Looking forward to talking to you.
Let's talk about, you know, I can only imagine when it comes to putting something like this together. You know, if you try to throw a surprise party for somebody, that's one thing. You try to throw a birthday party, a birthday dinner. How do you go from being at the Entergy Vice President General Counsel to chairing the Super Bowl Host Committee?
Well, you know, it starts with building relationships. So we have a great relationship with the New Orleans Saints, Entergy does. And I've worked with the Saints for a very long time as one of their major sponsors. So that relationship has been there. But we've also worked with the Great New Orleans Sports Foundation. Not as much in the past, but on this particular event, and Jay Cicero and that group has been involved in Super Bowls for the last four, certainly in New Orleans, and they do an incredible job. So when you take on something like this with a team like that, that's experienced, that understands all the ins and outs, it made the decision to get involved a lot easier.
So what did they tell you? And I always like the human part of this behind, you know what I'm saying, because it's easy to throw titles around.
Right.
So what did they tell you? Like, it's like, okay, I'll do it. Now what do I do? Where do you even start on this, Marcus?
That is a great question. When they came to me and asked me about this, and I sat down and I talked to Jay, and I sat down and I talked to the Saints executive team, and my question was, well, what am I supposed to
what
do?
What do you want me to do, right?
Is this ceremonial? Should I just show up and, you know, take pictures? But no, they said, look, we want you to be as involved as you want to be. And you know, so we've got 16 different subcommittees that do a lot of the work across the city in terms of meeting the obligations under our bid commitments to the NFL. And I work with teams all the time. And so I decided I wanted to really get involved. So I spent a lot of time with Jay Cicero and his team, and we do all the detail work that you would expect somebody to do in getting prepared for something like this. So it's been fun for me, and it's been a level of involvement that I didn't expect, but I'm glad I've done it.
Yeah. Talk about some of the details that go into this, because you know, I always give the example, Marcus, that stuff doesn't just happen. I don't care if you had a PTA meeting.
Right.
Somebody's got to set up the chairs. Somebody's got to pick them up, right?
Right.
That's got to be just exponentially more difficult when it comes to something like this, and that's part of what you did?
That's part of what the team...
Not setting up chairs, you know what I'm saying.
No, that's part of what the team does. When, you know, I mentioned meeting the obligations of the bid specifications. When you bid on the Super Bowl, you make all these commitments to the NFL. You know,
give me some examples. Like what?
Entertainment venues, infrastructure, parking, all the things that, you know, the host committee has to greet all the people when they come into the airport. All the details around having a good time in the city. We've got committees that are involved in doing that. We have to raise money, you know, to do all those things. We have to help host parties for NFL events. So the big media party that's going to take place tonight, you know, we have to put all that together. So it is a very detail-oriented list of things you have to do. But I mentioned, you know, the Sports Foundation has been doing this for a while, and so it's much easier when you're working with people who understand not just the big picture, but as you mentioned, the details, because there are a thousand little details in everything that goes along with this. It's like planning the party. It's like planning the party for the biggest sporting events in American culture. That's a different kind of party.
Yeah, it's so far beyond the game.
Yeah.
And talk about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, the game is just grown exponentially. I mean, we had the game in 2013. If you think about the game in terms of economic impact, about a $450 million economic impact in the region in 2013. The game was in Vegas last year. That number was far exceeded in Vegas, and we expect to far exceed that number here. And so you've got, you know, hundreds of millions of viewers. You've got social media where you've got billions of clicks on everything. You've got 6,000 credentialed media professionals who are in town for a week. And as you know, you put that many media professionals in a region, and what do? They're looking for stories to tell. And so all the different stories that people can tell about what's going on, you know, the music, the food, you know, the culture, but then all those other things outside of New Orleans, French Quarter, you know, you get in outside of the city and you're really seeing how people live and work. And then there's another component. This is a great state to do business in. And so the Governor Landry has really focused in on the economic development component of that.
Oh, the party, right, coming up?
Yeah, there's a 14,000 square foot pavilion that the state has built, you know, not far from here on Convention Center Row. And we're going to be hosting corporations, CEOs, leaders of companies. So there we can have an opportunity to sort of plus sell or cross sell. You know, this is the state where the clean energy transition is going to take place. We've got space facilities. You know, we've got incredible, talented people in construction. There's just so many things about this region. We've got multiple universities right clustered in this area. There's just so many things about this state that are well beyond, you know, what the game brings in terms of the fun. There's a lot of business to be done here as well.
That's the other thing I wanted to talk about, because it's all about networking, right?
Right.
Or, you know, this guy, and it all comes down to, I talked about the human angle before, about personal relationships.
Right.
This is, I don't know that there's a better opportunity for corporate networking or business development than is the Super Bowl, is there?
I doubt that there is. Every corporation, every major corporation is represented here, and usually by their executive teams.
Mm-hmm.
And
so the people you want to talk to.
The people you want to talk to, the people who make decisions about, you know, where the company takes its strategy, how they execute, you know, where they want to do business next. So it's a great opportunity for that. You know, no doubt there's a lot of fun involved, and that's okay. But as we say, you know, if on Monday morning these people get to the airport and they have beignet dust on their pants and they got a hurricane headache for drinking too much, and that's all they take from New Orleans, we will have failed in our mission. Mm-hmm. So we expect that we will use this as an opportunity to build upon the business relationships and to bring things back to our state that will really help continue to spur the economic development that we've seen.
But having interviewed people like you and your peers, business is never far from your mind. You talk about beignet dust and hurricanes. That might be part of it, but let's be honest, Marcus, the big guys and big women in the companies, they're always doing business, right?
We're always doing business. I mean, our involvement is tied to usually what's important to our customers. Entergy is a founding partner, and people have asked, well, why would Entergy get involved in this? Well, anything that helps to bring this kind of economic development to our region is going to help our customers. If it helps our customers, it actually helps us as well. And so we're trying to do whatever we can to drive growth, you know, and wealth development in our region. We're the only Fortune 500 company headquartered in New Orleans, one of only two in the state of Louisiana. We think that it should be more. And, you know, the Super Bowl is an incredible event. We've had 11. You know, we're tied with Miami. But think about this. two Fortune 500 companies in the state, and yet we compete against New York, L.A., you know, San Francisco, places where, you know, the populations are much larger and the corporate presence is much greater. So the ability for us to punch above our weight says a lot about what we can actually do. Now we want to do, what we'd like to do is expand that and have that help to grow the business region as well. So this is going to be fun, plenty of it. And business, hopefully plenty of that as well.
I don't think also the average person thinks, and it took me until later in my life to realize this, how you have to think decades down the line. Right. You can't think a year down the line. You can't think 5 years down the line. If you could, Marcus, talk about that and how an event like this helps position the city and the region in a better way for 10 and 20 years down
sure.
the line.
Well, when you think about, just think about the planning process timeline for the Super Bowl. This was awarded to us, I think, roughly in 2018. So we've been planning for 6 years for this event. And when you start planning for this event, sure, there's the infrastructure. You know, there's all of the details around the city that you want to get done right. But then you have time to plan how this might strategically play well into your strategy long term for a business and for the city and for a region as a whole. So our partners at the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, particularly with new Governor Landry, you know, it's given us an opportunity to really get together and plan on how we want to take this opportunity and try and really capitalize on it. I mean, the, you know, this is a time in our country where you can find a lot of divisiveness. It can be difficult to put 15 people in the room and have them agree on anything. I have never seen anything more unifying for our business and political community than the Super Bowl. I have every room I have been in, everybody across the region has one goal, and that is to make this the best experience that anybody who comes here could possibly have. Because, one, we want to have number 12, Super Bowl, come back. But, two, we want to get all the benefits that come from having people here. So it has been an incredible motivator and driver of, you know, the kind of camaraderie and the kind of unified thinking that you'd like to see your leaders have. We've seen nothing but that.
And the reason I mention that is that, you know, back in the day, you're from here originally, right?
Well, I've been here 37 years.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you your citizenship.
I don't know at what point, yeah, you can stay, but I've been here 37 years.
No, you can stay because, you know, back in the day, they'd measure Mardi Gras success by weighing the garbage, and they got away from that.
Right.
But the reason I wanted to bring up 20 years down the line, you don't really know the economic impact of this Super Bowl. You might not know for 5, 10, 15 years. Right.
Right. And there are two ways to look at that. You know, New Orleans is a tourism city. So on the one hand, you know, as we grow this city and we grow our tourism base, I think there's some talk about building, for example, the 1,000-room hotel on the very spot of the convention center. If you've never been here, after 6,000 media members tell stories for a week, you're going to want to come here. If you've been here, after hearing all those stories, you're going to want to come back. So on the tourism side, we're going to drive that. But at the same time, think about what's happening in our nation. You know, energy costs, people want cleaner options, people want economic development in their regions. We've got this great opportunity. If there's a clean energy transition, it's going to come right through Louisiana. You know, we've got the pipelines, we've got gas and oil, you know, we've got electricity, we've got talented, capable workers. I mean,
it's not either or.
It's all
monetize
above.
Monetize it, right? That's the point.
It's all above, yep. You know, it's all above. And so I think this is going to be a driver of both our traditional tourism, but also those other areas of business that we really have, I think, an advantage across the nation.
You're a young man. Hang on a second. I say that because, you know, I'm from here originally, and I go back to, I can remember as a young child, Kansas City playing Minnesota first Super Bowl here, then Dallas played Miami, having to go to Belchase, where I now live. At that point, it was the end of the world to pirate a signal off of a broadcast facility in Baton Rouge to get the game because it was blacked out here, same thing in the Dallas-Miami game. When it comes to Jay Cicero and those guys, have they spoken about just how the Super Bowl has changed and grown so much bigger than just the last time it was here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we talk about that all the time. I mean, you know, this has been a huge learning curve for me, but for Jay and his team who've been through this, they've been able to watch incrementally as the Super Bowl has made these huge jumps in terms of viewership, in terms of the number of people who actually participate. The things that make a Super Bowl attractive to the NFL, for example, the fact that the Saints have spent $500 million upgrading the Superdome. You know, so that facility is 50 years old, I think. It was built in 1975, roughly. 50 years old this year. That facility on the inside is roughly a new facility.
Looks brand
so new. You think about all the planning. You talked about the planning, the things that people do to make sure you stay relevant and competitive. That's a big piece of it. I mean, that is a huge piece of the fact, you know, the technology in there. There used to be a time you go in some of these facilities and you couldn't make a phone call out. You, like I said, you couldn't call your mama and them.
They used to page you, right?
They'd say
doctor number 385, whatever it is, call your service, right?
Remember? Exactly. And now the technology has been upgraded in a way that the experience, the fan experience, the food, you know, the venues, the vistas that you can see the game from are going to be incredible. All of those things make the game better, make the game more special, makes us more competitive, and it keeps bringing more people back. It's our, you know, that and our people. Those are our competitive advantages. I mean,
this is the first time I met you, but I can sense that you're a guy that doesn't like to take credit. You're a team builder. You like to give credit to everybody else. But if, after all of this is over, you were to look back and say, you know what, that probably wouldn't have been like that if I hadn't have been involved, what would you say?
No, what I would say is that I'm going to appreciate the experience that I've had. I'm going to appreciate the fact that I've got to work with some really incredible people. I mean, across the region, and from Chevron and Ochsner and New Orleans and Company. I mean, you talk about the passion these people have for this region and this city. That's been really, really enriching for me. But there is one selfish thing that I would like to take away from this. And it's a shared experience, but I would feel, you know, some personal pride. If we were able to get number 12, if we were able to get the next Super Bowl back here in New Orleans, I would feel like our team.
You had a hand in it because you pulled this one off so well.
Well, accurate? I would feel like we've done our job on behalf of all the citizens of this region and in this state that we brought another one back here. So that's what we're working to do.
See, I tell you, you don't want to take credit for anything. Yeah. I knew it when he sat down. Marcus, a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure
thank
to
you
meet
for coming
you
by.
Too.
Right?
Thank you.
Marcus Brown, chair of the Super Bowl committee and a senior counsel and vice president at Entergy 944. Quick break here on WWL. Derek Cumming, Tommy Tucker back at the New Orleans Convention Center. We're here at the Host Committee's Media Center, Radio Row and Memorial Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So, celebrating Game Week. Derek Cummings joins us, the Bay Area Host Committee. Good morning, Derek. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well.
Thanks for taking the time. So while California has hosted a bunch of Super Bowls, the Bay Area has only hosted one prior it was Super Bowl 50, right?
Yeah, pretty significant one. First one to not use the Roman numerals, so pretty special from a branding standpoint, yeah. And as we were just talking before we came on, it was about 80 degrees that day when the game was played. So
it's going to be, if we're going to compete here, I think it's going to be a perfect 72 in a dome on Sunday.
I mean,
so
you guys have Mother Nature, but you've canceled her out. Right?
Yeah.
Take her out of the equation.
And we were talking before we started, the coldest Super Bowl ever played actually was in New Orleans when Pittsburgh played Minnesota in Tulane Stadium, 75. But not the point. Tell me what you're doing here as the chairman of the with the host committee.
Not chairman.
With the host committee. What do you do now here? What are you doing?
Well, same as you guys had presence last year in Las Vegas. It is
killing time schmoozing?
Yeah. A lot of that, you know. For some of the members of the team, myself included, I guess it's a quasi boondoggle, if you will. No, not at all. It is the representation of, you know, there's a long line of host committees that have worked to make these events run as smoothly as possible, and you're here ceremoniously to work through the celebration of finishing one. And the handoff to the other.
But you know what? I wanted to ask you about that because it is an extremely competitive thing, as it should be, because it's a huge event, right? But
I mean to receive a Super Bowl and to have them.
To compete to get the Super Bowl. That's what I'm saying. But with that being said, once it's awarded, I would imagine you guys, all the different committees, kind of share notes, what went right, what went wrong, what can be done to get better with the NFL? Everybody gets together in a room or what?
Yeah, I think the you know, each year, each team in each city is different. Some have host committees that have been established for many, many years and are always in they have a longevity behind them and have worked for many years. And then there are some like ourselves. We were just stood up in 2022. So there was a host committee for 50. But then that, you know, that ran its course and evaporated, I believe, a year and a half after, 2 years after. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was stood up in, you know, or this version of a host committee in the Bay Area was stood up in 2022. And the idea is that it will be around in perpetuity to continue to place the bids and win bids on global events like the one we'll be having next year.
I was just talking to Marcus Brown, who I'm sure you know, chair of the Super Bowl host committee here. And I would ask you, what do you do back in the Bay Area, and how did you get involved with the host committee?
So the host committee there is, one, its primary goal is to unite the Bay Area through sport, right? Mm-hmm. We not only have the Super Bowl 60 coming on next year, but we have NBA All-Star Weekend next weekend.
Big event.
From this, yep, mm-hmm. Another big event, which you guys have hosted
yep.
many times,
yep.
To great fanfare here, right? Mm-hmm. It's a great city
sure,
for that.
Absolutely. Final
but,
Four, too.
Yeah. So then we have Super Bowl 60 next February in 26, and we will be the first ever city to host both a Super Bowl and a World Cup competition in the same year, and we have that in June of 2026.
Look, it's not a competition, but I think we did have a Super Bowl and a March Madness in the same year before, did we not? I think. Maybe not. If not, let's just go with it.
Okay.
What do you do back in the Bay Area?
So we are prepping.
You personally. What
personally.
Do you do? Yeah.
Oh, personally, I help with the marketing side and the experiential event. So I'm helping to create what will be for the fans and the community inside the Bay Area, you know, the nine counties of the Bay, mm-hmm. to come together, because not everyone will be able to attend all of the matches, say for World Cup. Not everyone will be able to attend the Super Bowl, right? But to make the environment as cohesive and as fun for all the communities in the Bay Area. So
I kid around, but that World Cup is a huge, giant accomplishment. When does that happen in a year?
June 11th is the start and the launch of the World Cup, and it runs through July.
You're not going to have time to catch your breath.
No, not at all. Not from the Super Bowl to the World Cup.
Pace yourself, Derek.
Yeah.
A pleasure to talk to you. Nice meeting you.
Tommy,
and,
thanks for having us.
Enjoy the city, enjoy the game, and hopefully I'll see you next year if you can get that trip comped for me.
Yeah, we'll have to work that out, right?
All right, thank you, sir. We'll take a break. We come back, we'll find out what Newell's going to do today. WWO broadcasting live from the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, Morial Convention Center, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. That was Derek Cummings, the Bay Area Host Committee in the Treasure Chest Casino Power Seat. Back in a flash on WWL.